Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. The Wyoming legislature has passed the halfway point in its 40-day general session. We're taking this Open Spaces to focus on some big themes, like how some bills may end up affecting how Wyoming residents and businesses handle taxes.
People need to understand that these taxes pay for services. So property taxes are the big one. They pay for local services.
There are a lot of bills that will potentially affect K-12 school education. We talked to three stakeholders, including a teacher.
So removing that accountability, I'm worried that the combination of those two bills is essentially going to create a welfare program.
And one bill could have Wyoming join 19 other states in calling for a rare convention proposing amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Hey there, this is Caitlin Tan, Energy and Natural Resources reporter. The Trump administration is taking action to reduce the size of the federal government and the workforce, and we want to hear from you if you work for or with the federal government. Let us know how these changes are affecting you. You can fill out an anonymous form on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, so we can get a clearer picture of what's going on. Thank you.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. As I mentioned at the top, we're past the halfway point of the Wyoming legislature, so this episode's going to focus on takeaways so far. We start with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus's strategy. After the Wyoming Freedom Caucus and its allies took control of the House last year, planning for the ongoing legislative session ramped up. They had to consider which bills to prioritize and which strategies would work best to get them passed. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports on an emerging pattern and how, in some ways, it mirrors a tactic used in national politics.
Jesse Rubino is the Wyoming State Director for the Freedom Caucus, which is one of 12 Freedom Caucuses in legislatures across the U.S. When lawmakers meet in Cheyenne, Rubino says she analyzes many of the bills that get filed from a liberty and constitutional perspective, sharing suggestions on how members of the faction should vote via email.
There's been more bills filed this session than any in recent memory.
555 bills, to be exact, were received for introduction in the House and Senate. A lot of those measures can be grouped by the hot-button issues they're addressing, like abortion restrictions and gun control rollbacks.
In the marketplace of ideas, the more ideas are better because in the end, the best ideas will win out. And so the more bills there are, the more there is to work with, including if there are multiple vehicles to achieve the same policy goal.
Representative Lawley, Protecting Women's Privacy and Public Spaces Act. And
what is a woman act?
Mr. Speaker.
This rejection of all transgender female athletes, it is another form of extremism.
And the remaining parts of the destroyed fetus will get flushed down the toilets, poisoning our drinking.
Illegal immigration, identify, report, detain, and deport.
This goes back to the discussion we had.
Some of those measures bear striking resemblance to the more than 60 executive orders President Donald Trump signed since taking office. Things like ramping up deportations for immigrants and banning transgender people from sports teams. GOP-controlled legislatures like Wyoming's will have to step in to make some of Trump's policy projects happen, since local governments are mostly subordinate to states on certain issues, not the feds. Gillette Representative Christopher Knapp, vice chair of the Freedom Caucus, echoed that sentiment at a recent press conference in the Capitol Rotunda.
We'll definitely be kind of mirroring what's happening nationally, but you'll see us try to take advantage of that too to put Wyoming in a better place for the future.
He expects Wyoming to adopt Trump's policies and to prod the new administration into giving the state more leeway in areas like energy development. But the deluge of bills has hit at least one snag that Trump doesn't have to deal with. Legislative deadlines that mean bills are dying in droves.
Political science has kind of well documented the fact that oftentimes, it's the position on an issue that is a more valuable commodity than, you know, the actual policy outcome.
Ryan Williamson is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wyoming. He says that even if lots of bills die, the high volume gives their sponsors talking points for future campaigns, and it makes it more likely at least some will cross the finish line. Plus, they can overwhelm the opposition.
There's just so much information. This information saturation means some stuff doesn't get the coverage or the attention that it might under other circumstances.
Former Representative Dan Zwanitzer, a moderate Republican, agreed.
I mean, that's really, I think, the strategy at both the national level and with the Freedom Caucus and the Wyoming legislature.
Zwanitzer lost to a caucus-endorsed candidate in the August primary after serving in the House for 20 years, but he's still in the loop.
Every day there's something new for the press to try to cover. By the time you can get caught up on one thing, there's four more that have come up, and you just throw up your hands and say, guess, yeah, you can't fight it all, and you just quit fighting.
As for the caucus's state director, Jesse Rubino, she thinks the more ideas submitted, the better. But that's not necessarily an intentional strategy for the faction or their freshman allies.
They're just normal, everyday people. And they were elected because they didn't see a lot of the policies having the success that they wished that they had had in previous years.
Rubino says the caucus sourced policy ideas from their constituents through door knocking and internal polling, and from the Bible.
I would say that the shared faith in Jesus amongst the Freedom Caucus and our conservative allies in the Wyoming House and Senate doesn't just drive the legislative priorities that the members have, it drives everything that they do.
For some of the Wyoming legislation mirrored by Trump's actions, like one bill that would establish legal definitions for both sexes, state lawmakers have amended them to match his executive orders. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements, reporting from the Capitol.
Up next, we'll hear WyoFile and Wyoming Public Radio reporters sharing standouts of the session so far on our weekly Cheyenne Roundup on Open Spaces.
Join Wyoming Public Radio for a trip around Wyoming. We bring you news from just down the street and across the state four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. This winter, Wyoming Public Radio is teaming up with WyoFile to bring you weekly updates from the legislative session. It's called the Cheyenne Roundup, and you can hear it here in just a moment or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and WyoFile. I'm Jordan Uplinger, Wyoming Public Radio's State House reporter, and with me is WyoFile state government and politics reporter, Maggie Mullen.
Happy to be here. So, Jordan, we've reached a milestone.
This past Wednesday was the halfway point of this year's 40-day legislative session.
We thought it would be a good time to check in with our colleagues.
We've asked them to share moments from the first half of the session that feel emblematic of the attitudes and energy of that session.
Let's get started with WyoFile. Education reporter Katie Klingsporn has been following a contentious debate on House Bill 199. That's the Wyoming Freedom Scholarship Act. Klingsporn told us that Casper Republican Representative Steve Harshman's remarks show how high emotions run around the idea of universal school vouchers, even among Republicans.
Boy, I think we passed a pretty good bill last year. Maybe we made a mistake and we let the camel's nose under the tent. And I guess if I had hindsight and thought, we're going to now go ahead and ignore this Constitution and the articles and just throw out $7,000 to anybody that wants it.
To understand the context of this quote, it's important to understand the rise of the school choice movement across the United States. And also the education savings account program that passed last year in Wyoming, which offered income qualified families money to pay for non-public school costs like tuition for private school, and that included pre-K costs. The new bill, House 199, is a universal voucher program, which means it offers $7,000 to any family regardless of income for non-public school costs, but this time it doesn't include pre-K. The measure has inspired intense debate, with opponents calling it unconstitutional and proponents saying that it represents school choice for parents. It passed the House easily and is now being considered in the Senate.
Staying in the House of Representatives, Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor has been tracking efforts to create more affordable housing in the state. Let's start by hearing from Gillette Republican Representative Christopher Knapp.
This is our last day for getting bills through committee. And to the two bills that didn't get heard, which was House Bill 332 and House Bill 68, I offer my apologies.
Knapp is the chairman of the Corporations Committee, and that committee has had a lot on its plate, including a mountain of election security-related bills. Sometimes the committee even met twice in one day, but in the end, it wasn't enough to get through all the bills. One of the bills you can hear Knapp apologizing for in the clip we just played was about affordable housing. House Bill 68 would have given cities and towns the ability to finance infrastructure upgrades by borrowing from their future tax revenue. It's called tax increment financing, and basically everyone involved in the housing space, from municipalities to builders to nonprofits, want to use it to get more affordable housing in their communities. House Bill 68 was one of six affordable housing bills filed this session. Five of those bills, including this one, died without any discussion.
So housing hasn't gotten much traction this session, but immigration has. And Wildfile reporter Andrew Graham has been following lawmakers' attitude toward immigrants. He pointed to a recent comment Cheyenne Republican Representative Lee Filer made during a presentation by the Wyoming Highway Patrol to the House Judiciary Committee. Graham said it represents a view held by many in the Wyoming state capitol.
Not even 100 miles south of here, this is allowed. The stuff that, you know, they're allowed to just come in. And to believe it or not, there's probably just someone that just want to go to work. But we need to give you guys the right tools and these troopers the right tools to make sure that, one, they're protected, and two, they're protecting us.
That was Representative Filer asking a Wyoming Highway Patrol commander to bring lawmakers budget requests for the kinds of enhanced equipment, including bulletproof vehicles and drones, that Wyoming troopers saw used by their counterparts in Texas on a deployment to the U.S.-Mexico border last summer. When Filer talks about 100 miles south of here, he's referring to Denver and other Colorado municipalities with more liberal views on immigration. While Filer suggested that, quote, believe it or not, unquote, some people migrate to Wyoming to work, most of the conversation focused on immigration as a huge threat. And at that meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, there were no immigrant families or advocates for those communities to counter this perception that most people coming into the country illegally are here to commit other crimes or otherwise disrupt public safety. The legislature this year has treated illegal immigration as a threat the state needs to solve, largely by making it more difficult for undocumented immigrants to live here. I've heard many times this session the catchphrase, every state is a border state. But what's largely been lost in the echo chamber of the statehouse this year is just how embedded many of those immigrants are in the state's small towns and in the fabric of Wyoming's economy. Those voices just aren't heard in the halls of the statehouse. One particularly onerous piece of legislation to crack down on immigrants, a bill brought by Torrington Republican Sherry Steinmetz, briefly changed that dynamic. Her bill would have criminalized transporting or sheltering an undocumented person. It was so scary to immigrant communities, particularly people in families where some members are citizens and some aren't, that it drew a wave of public opposition and, in many ways, a bunch of new voices to the statehouse. Senators killed that bill with a 20-10 vote. Other immigration-related legislation continues on, however.
Switching gears, Wyoming Public Radio's natural resources and energy reporter, Caitlin Tan, has been keeping an eye on conversations around climate change and the state's energy policy going forward.
For years, Wyoming has generally agreed on the science that shows climate change is happening. That means figuring out how to combat things like water shortages and drought, and then figuring out how to reduce emissions if we want to see our legacy industries survive, like coal. So two ways that Wyoming has done that. One is the cloud seeding program. The hope is for more water for ag users and Colorado River Basin states downstream of us. And then the second is carbon capture technology. Lots of money, laws, and time have gone into developing it. But this year, we're seeing efforts to undo all of that, largely based on unfounded conspiracies, like climate change isn't real, or cloud seeding chemicals are harming bighorn sheep. I think Rock Springs Representative J.T. Larson captures that. He was speaking to fellow lawmakers about a bill to stop cloud seeding.
On one hand, we are saying that this cloud seeding program is potentially dangerous for water users. But on the other hand, we're saying emissions from coal-fired plants have no impact on the climate. So what is it? Are emissions causing an impact on our climate, or are we, or I'm just trying to figure that out. I'm trying to reconcile that, because I believe this is the climate hoax is a problem with our coal emissions. I mean, that it's just a hoax in my opinion, but I think this has been an effective program. So I don't know. I'm just trying to drill down on that, because I feel like we're conflicting on two things.
Two bills are moving forward in this realm. One would end carbon capture efforts, and the other is a water project funding bill. And most recently, Sublette County Representative Mike Schmid amended it to strip funding for all cloud seeding projects in the state. And if passed, this all could fundamentally change Wyoming's approach to energy and water issues going forward.
Speaking of Representative Schmid, he's been at the center of several bills that WildFiles, Wildlife and Natural Resources reporter Mike Cosgrove has been following. That includes a proposal to allow unlimited mountain lion killing that got some strong reactions.
We had very robust discussion on this bill within my board. There are quite a few who are in favor of it. Some are being quite impacted, they feel, by excessive lion numbers. In the end, we came to the conclusion that wildlife management is better left in the hands of wildlife managers.
So that is Wyoming Outfitters and Guides Association President Lee Livingston. He's an outfitter and former county commissioner who lives in Cody, testifying in regards to a bill that would have required unlimited mountain lion killing all around the state, just doing away with any types of controls on mountain lion mortality. It was very controversial, and there have been a number of very controversial wildlife bills this legislative session. A couple that were related to grizzly bears. There was a bill that was going to separate how whitetail and mule deer were going to be managed. And none of those measures has survived. A lot of them have run into opposition, and they died pretty early in the legislative process, owing in part to opposition from people like Lee Livingston. There are other wildlife bills moving. One of them comes out of the incident that happened in Sublette County with a wolf that was brought into a bar last year. Another one would do away with a state protected status for wildlife species. But a lot of these really hot button controversial bills have died because of testimony from people like Lee Livingston.
A lot of the wildlife that Mike just mentioned depend on federal land in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach has been following a resolution that would demand the U.S. Congress to hand over 30 million acres, all federal land in Wyoming, except Yellowstone.
That resolution is now dead, but there was a lot of fiery debate before that. One moment stood out to me when it was considered by the Senate Agriculture Committee. It shows how we're seeing a resurgence in Wyoming and the West of conservatives defying the Fed's authority to own land. But Alec Underwood with the Wyoming Outdoor Council had a lot of questions. Like, how would the state take over wildfire and grazing management?
While also ensuring that the public has access to public lands and that the habitat for wildlife on public lands be maintained.
Sir, thanks for your testimony, but I'm going to push back on that.
Then Senator Tim French, a Powell Republican, chimed in.
I would much rather the people of the state of Wyoming control the lands. I think the local people should have the say. The feds are always...
He basically used this as an opportunity to bash the feds. He goes on to say that the feds have closed roads and limited access, and the state would do a much better job. And...
realize how many billions upon billions of dollars would come to the state of Wyoming, the people of Wyoming, if we got all the mineral money.
This argument that Wyoming can demand this land is based on an interpretation of the U.S. Constitution that many say isn't legally sound. The resolution had a really bumpy ride in the Senate. It failed only to be resurrected and then fail again on a tie vote. It's dead for now, but I don't think these kinds of arguments are going away anytime soon.
We'll be back next week with an update on that and, of course, all things Wyoming legislature.
Thanks for listening to Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers are up to during the 2025 legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and Wyofile. New episodes drop every Friday throughout the session. Editing and producing by Tennessee Watson and Camila Godolska. Follow our ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wyofile.com. And thanks again for listening.
The Cheyenne Roundup will be back on February 21st. You can find it every Friday late afternoon on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, we dive deep into some big topics that have come up in the session, like education and taxes. Stay with us on Open Spaces.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming sounds, jazz Wyoming, and classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
As Westerners, we're a unique people.
It's not the horse, it's you. Okay? That's the bottom line.
With stories as big as our landscapes.
We're superhuman to survive.
That's why we deserve a podcast celebrating our shared identity.
Use this space to heal your heart.
Listen to all 8 seasons of The Modern West at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Education has been a big topic during this legislative session, specifically affecting K-12 schools in the state. Over 20 bills were filed in the House and Senate, and they span from changing the number of school days to funding schools and curriculums. We checked in with 3 stakeholders on a couple of key bills that have been moving forward. I spoke with Dylan Ford, a 7th grade English teacher who's also the president of the Cheyenne Teachers Education Association, which is a local group for certified staff. Carrie Klein is an advocate for the Wyoming Public Charter School Association. The group works on policies and laws that align with their mission to help support charter schools. And I spoke to Kim Amon, a 32-year-old veteran educator and the current president of the Wyoming Education Association, which advocates for public schools in the states. The bills we discussed had a couple overarching themes, and we started with school choice. What does school choice mean to you?
I'm all for school of choice. It should be the right of any parent to make choices for their kids' classroom, but it shouldn't come at the expense of public school students.
I like to phrase it, I guess, more of school options or educational freedom. I believe that families and kids, they don't all come in one size fits all, and they all have different learning styles. And I think the more options we have in our system to allow parents and kids the ability to pick and choose and find the fit for them, I think the better everything is. And, you know, I would just remind everybody that charter schools are public schools. So we are part of the public school system, and a lot of what we see happening now does affect us as well.
I would echo some of the same sentiments that both Dylan and Carrie said. Of course, everyone should have a choice. The problem is, from our perspective, that our public school educators have been so tied down with legislation and bureaucracy that they no longer have the freedom to teach students the way they need to be taught. For instance, we know, Carrie is right, we know that all students learn differently. We know every year your students in your classroom change. So every year you have to have some flexibility. The problem with placing such stringent rules and demands on our public schools is that that really limits choice for everybody.
So in relation to school choice, some of the bills that I've observed is Wyoming trying to pass bills that would open up school options for students by helping them pay for private schools, reducing homeschoolers' requirements to check in with local school districts, and allowing more charter schools. Let's start with Carrie and Kim first. So how do you think this would impact education in the state?
They're all different. House Bill 199, the Savings Account Freedom Scholarship, really is probably the most devastating of the bills, in our opinion, because that has absolutely no accountability whatsoever to anyone who takes the money. And so if you are a parent and you have two children and you get $14,000 to send your children to what school you want, that's great, except for there's no check on that school, whether or not they're meeting curriculum standards that are set by the state Department of Education, and parents and communities have input in all of those. And so again, you have the same pot of money that is being given to public schools and charter schools, but you do not have the same accountability in that specific bill. That particular bill would give no accountability and none of the same standards to that people receiving that. So what it does is it cuts funding for our public school systems. We know that private schools cost more than $7,000 per student per year. And so it would largely benefit families who already have their students in a private school. But students who live in poverty and their families who live in poverty could never afford that. So that leaves lower income, more vulnerable students, and also more special ed students in the public schools with less resources.
Okay, Carrie, how would you respond to that?
Officially, charter schools have no position on House Bill 199. As broadly supporters of all school choice or options, I will say, just on a side note, you know, we've been following the bill, watching the conversations. I do think there's been some amendments made to add back in some accountability measures. The charter schools legislations, we've got a couple of bills going. The one that would remove the arbitrary cap or moratorium on the ability for the Wyoming State Authorizing Board for charter schools to look at applications. Currently, they can't look at any other applications until 2029, which means that a new charter school would not open under their authority until school year 2030. And so we just feel like that's number one, arbitrary. And, you know, we have the state board that was authorized. They're highly educated. They have great expertise on the board. And we feel they should really be allowed the opportunity to vet any applicants. And if we look at some of the states around us, what we see is that there's not going to be this influx of charter schools. There's no fly-by-night schools that are suddenly going to open overnight. It's about an 18-month process once you're approved or once you start the application process. And so I think that it's really not going to be this huge sudden influx of charter schools in Wyoming like a lot of people believe.
Dylan, how do you see these impacting teachers?
I'm worried about what the combination of some of these bills will do. For instance, HB 199, this is the voucher program. So it funds the vouchers by diverting federal mineral royalties, which would have normally gone to public schools to fund the vouchers. Not sure where it's going to end up as far as the certification process, but combining that with the fact that, like, when a student leaves a public school, we lose the funding as a district. Combining that with the Homeschool Freedom Act, HB 46, which removes the requirement for homeschool parents to get their curriculum approved by school districts. So removing that accountability, I'm worried that the combination of those two bills is essentially going to create a welfare program that's funded at the expense of our kids who are in public schools. In addition to that, the charter school authorizations is going to make it difficult for all public schools, including charter schools, to know what funds they're going to have available the following year. And while I understand that there might not be an influx of charter schools all at once, I think it would be responsible for the legislature to have those safeguards in place to say, this is how many open up this year. And then that way, public schools will know what funds they have to work with and what funds they can rely on for student programs.
Does anyone want to respond to anything?
I did want to respond just for a minute on the opening of charter schools. The problem with removing the cap, in our opinion, is that it costs $14 million when we just open the new charter schools. And again, that money comes out of the public school funds. It's not extra money. We have a limited amount of funding in this state, which is actually under attack as we look at it now. There are several bills that are trying to lower the budget for education and cut funding. But at the same time, we're also expanding options. You can't have more schools with less money and have everybody have an equal playing field.
So another theme I've seen is parental rights. One bill, and this is in a nutshell, but it would require teachers and school personnel to notify parents about curriculums before the year starts and of any instruction, training, or presentations on gender identity, sexual orientation, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Dylan, let's start with you. How would this affect teachers around Wyoming?
So the original language behind this bill was probably the scariest in my eyes from the day-to-day perspective of teaching. Now, it's since been amended to remove all of those posting requirements, all of the lawsuit language, as well as the addition at the end where it could be grounds for firing. But it just seems like these parental rights bills aren't really focused on parental rights. It really just seems to be imposing politics on our classroom. They also seem to be written in a way that assume educators are bad actors in this. And it really seems to seek out to replace just regular conversations that teachers should be having and educators in general should be having with parents, and replacing that with like laws, litigiousness, and other things that really should have no place in school.
I don't think as the charter school movement or as our association, we're taking any positions on that particular bill at this time. We really strive as our association to talk to our school leaders, find out what they need. You know, inherently charter schools are not top down, they're bottom up. And so parents, teachers have a large voice in what's happening in the school.
It's parental rights in the public schools, but the argument of the accountability in a voucher program for a private school, when asked that question, the proposers of that said, well, it's up to the parents. That's the parents' job. I would argue it's the same thing in the public school. Parents have a responsibility to talk to their teachers and meet with their teachers and make sure that they're talking to the administrators. It does appear that it's specifically targeting public school educators, when if that's really what you're after, it should target everybody who's receiving that money.
That was Dylan Ford, president of the Cheyenne Teachers Education Association, Carrie Klein with the Wyoming Public Charter School Association, and Kim Amon of the Wyoming Education Association. They were speaking with me about K-12 education bills that are going through the session. The last time the U.S. Constitution was amended was a generation ago, and it was done by Congress. But there's another way to change the founding document that's never been tested. State legislatures can call for a convention. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Mersbach takes us inside the Convention of States movement gaining steam in our region.
Kate, raise your right hand and repeat after me.
On the opening day of the Wyoming legislature, Republican State Senator Eric Barlow says he takes his oath of office seriously.
And that oath of office says you're going to uphold the Constitution of Wyoming and the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
He's one of many conservatives across the country who want to alter the U.S. Constitution. The goal? Limit federal power in three ways.
Term limits for federal officials, restraint on federal spending, and then just restraint on regulation, if you will.
They're part of a movement called Convention of States, which invokes Article 5 of the Constitution to call a convention to propose amendments. They want to bring power back to the states.
This would be about as direct a democracy as you can get.
The Constitution says at least 34 states have to call for a convention. Over the past decade, 19 have signed up, including Utah and Arizona. This year, Idaho and New Mexico could also join. But many fear this process could derail, even destroy, the Constitution as Americans know it.
Even if we're called on a particular topic, could it be a runaway convention?
Constitutional law expert Erwin Chemerinsky says that's what happened back in 1787.
They decided not to amend the Articles of Confederation, but to draft a whole new constitution.
Chemerinsky agrees with those who think the Constitution could be more reflective of the times. But he worries a convention of states wouldn't be bipartisan amid so much political division. Marguerite Herman with the Wyoming League of Women Voters says a convention, if called, would send one representative per state to speak for all the residents, and worries about representation for a long list of issues.
Freedom of speech, civil rights, civil liberties, privacy rights, the guarantee of equal protection under the law, the right to vote, immigration issues, the right to counsel.
Amidst all these concerns, Convention of States supporters are trying to prove they could keep a convention reined in and focus on a tight agenda. They've held simulated events, think Model UN, except for lawmakers from across the country. The last one was in 2023.
We are coming to you live this morning from Colonial Williamsburg.
That's a presenter at the two-day event where Republican Representative Ken Ivory of Utah steps in to set the tone.
We have a machine that's out of balance.
He stands in front of a giant American flag and addresses a sea of suits.
It's time to put the machine in the repair shop.
Convention goers then vote to create new term limits for Congress, balance the budget, and rein in federal powers.
Wisconsin. Wyoming.
43 yeas, 5 nays, and the proposal has been approved.
If this really happened, 3/4 of all states, including those that didn't push for a convention, would still have to ratify any new amendments.
I didn't just come up with this and say, oh, this is a great idea. I understand and everything.
In Wyoming, Barlow, the state senator, is one of the many to be convinced that a convention of states can work.
I traveled all over the country 4 different times to meetings of constitutional experts.
And what gave him confidence?
I think it's going to be hard for anything to get adopted, amended into the Constitution that doesn't have very broad support across the country.
As the sun sets on the legislature's opening day, Barlow says he'll keep following what he sees as his oath of office. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
Discharge the duties of my office.
Stay with us as we break down a couple of the tax-related bills going through the legislature. This is Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Taxes are a big focus state lawmakers have this year. More than 60 bills seek to tweak taxes we as people and businesses pay, from property to coal to manufacturing to vehicles. We wanted a bigger picture on how these bills might play off of each other. So Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger went to the Wyoming Taxpayers Association. The research and advocacy group has been around since 1937. It lobbies for a tax system that's justified, equitable, stable, and transparent for people and businesses in Wyoming.
We're here to educate and understand all taxes they pay and what those go to.
Hank Hoversland is the association's executive director. Uplinger started by asking him which of the bills the association is tracking is he paying particular attention to.
Residential property taxes are a major issue that is being considered by the legislature this year. And so I think people need to understand what property taxes are and what they fund. So we're monitoring a lot of property tax bills on residential property. But I would say for the Taxpayers Association, one bill that we believe is good that meets our cornerstones of taxation is a reduction of the coal severance tax rate to 6%, just to bring it on an even playing field and to even that playing field of severance taxes for all of our mineral industries.
There is kind of two important bills you touched on there, obviously the coal severance tax. We'll start with that, and then I want to transition over to that property tax bill that's been kind of controversial. With the coal severance tax, HB 75 would decrease the severance tax rate on surface coal from 6.5% to 6%. Can you explain just a little bit more in detail why this is, I think, maybe the only bill currently on your website's tracker that has a clear support on it?
Surface coal is the highest taxed mineral for purposes of severance taxes. So it's at 6.5%. Its competitors in oil and natural gas are down at the 6% range for the most part. And so bringing it into competition on that is something that we think is important, because we want to have equitable taxes on any mineral. And so we think that it's a good policy proposal that was brought forward.
Decreasing the coal severance tax rate is expected to bring in almost $10 million less in tax revenue next year for the general fund, the budget revenue account, and the school foundation program. In 2027 onward, it'd be more like $8 million less. The Taxpayers Association is also tracking a number of bills for property tax relief or reform.
So there's two competing bills that are going through right now. So House Bill 169 has passed the House, and that bill has a 50% exemption on single-family residence structures up to the first $1 million of fair market value. That does have a backfill provision in it, but it's only for half of the lost revenue. Senate File 69, on the other hand, is the same 50% exemption on the first $1 million of fair market value, but that includes both land and the structure. And the Senate on Committee of the Whole removed the backfill. And so we believe that it's important that people understand where their property taxes are going. It's going to local governments, and it provides services closest to the people. And so the state providing a backfill is going to be a major debate that's going to have to be settled between the two chambers. But yeah, I think those two bills, while they have similar ideas, are going to have competing interests on the backfill for the local governments and those services.
Is this how the Wyoming Taxpayers Association would have done it? Is this kind of a controversial way to provide relief through taxes?
While we don't have a position on the backfill or where it could come from, there's another competing bill that's out there. And there's sort of mirror bills, but they're slightly different. The Senate file is Senate File 153. And what that does is that it creates a definition in statute of what residential real property is. It also keeps the assessment ratio on residential and the owner-occupied subclass at 9.5%. The House bill, on the other hand, is slightly different because it changes the assessment ratios for residential, and it's the owner-occupied subclass down to 8.3%. So those are the differences, and I think that's one way that the legislature can also provide relief.
These are also bills that you're, according to the WTA, is still being monitored. You don't necessarily support these bills yet?
Correct. Yeah, we don't support or oppose a lot of these bills, but we're monitoring them because they affect the tax base in Wyoming.
On just a kind of broader note, we're going to be entering, both on a federal and state level here, a era of maybe new conservatism. Do you think that moving forward, we're going to see more bills, more politicians running on cutting taxes wherever they can across the board? Or do you think that there is kind of a hard line where you can't really cut anymore without affecting public services dramatically?
I think we saw that in 2024, and that's why we do have this new era and this new leadership in the legislature. And you know what? We welcome new ideas all the time, and we think that that taking a look at the whole tax structure and the tax system is a good idea. And we've seen those promises from the chairman of the Senate Revenue Committee, and we look forward to working with him and the Joint Revenue Committee in this interim as they take on this bold idea of reforming the tax structure in Wyoming. We think we want to be a part of that conversation. But getting back to your question on elections, I think we'll need to understand that these taxes pay for services. So property taxes are the big one. They pay for local services. Take community colleges, for example. If they start to lose some of that property tax revenue, they're going to have to find other ways to increase their revenues, and that might be on the backs of those students that are going to create the workforce of Wyoming. And so that's going to be a tuition increase or something like that. And so if citizens start to feel this reduction in services with not a full backfill or different things like that, I think that may affect voters and how they feel. So it's something that's going to be in play for certain in the future, and we're going to work to educate the public on that and continue to educate and give good sound research and numbers to lawmakers and the public so that they understand what these services are and what the taxes paid are.
Hank, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaking to the Wyoming Taxpayers Association's Hank Hoverslund. Not many would connect Wyoming with Tunisia, an African country situated on the northern part of the continent. Yet, the cowboy state and the country have had a relationship for over 20 years. In 2004, the Tunisian military was paired with the Wyoming National Guard as part of a U.S. Department of Defense program. The recent 20th anniversary has sparked renewed interest in the relationship, as the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia, Joey Hood, explained to me. But I first asked Hood how exactly the defense program partnership benefits both Wyoming and Tunisia.
Every program that we engage in, especially now under the Trump administration, has got to answer at least one of three questions. Does it make America stronger, safer, and more prosperous? And I think that is certainly true of this state partnership. It provides the Wyoming National Guard vital opportunities for using their skills out in the field in real-world situations. It also benefits Tunisia because it helps them train and receive equipment and learn how to take care of everything from natural disasters to responding to terrorist threats. And that has helped keep Tunisia stable, more secure and prosperous, which is of a benefit to us.
So in the past 20 years, have Wyoming National Guard members been stationed in Tunisia? Have Tunisian military members been stationed in Wyoming? Mm-hmm. How does that kind of physically work?
The exchanges go back and forth. There are always a couple of liaison officers that are stationed at the embassy that coordinate the activities. But these things can range from everything from officers and enlisted people going to training academies to organizing exercises together. They could be flying C-130s together, learning how to load and unload C-130 cargo aircraft more efficiently, learning how to provide humanitarian assistance together.
And you've been the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia for 2 years. And during that time, what stands out the most to you about this 20-year-long partnership and why?
I think what stands out most for me now is the potential that we've got. We're trying to expand beyond just the successful security partnership to include education and private sector development. And that's already off to a great start. Just a couple of months ago, representatives of the University of Wyoming were in Tunisia to sign MOUs, Memoranda of Understanding, with four Tunisian universities so that there can be exchanges of faculty and students, joint research projects, and lots of other activities. My experience from spending a day here at the University of Wyoming, I can tell that there's a lot of excitement from all across the disciplines, from archaeology to agriculture to business development, to work together with very smart and motivated Tunisians to bring lots of great benefit to the University of Wyoming, but in a way that also benefits the universities in Tunisia.
And as you mentioned, UW signed four new agreements with Tunisian universities just last year. And challenges that I read that the partnerships will try to address are water scarcity, sustainability, and productive use of land, conservation, and tourism. Can you go into more detail on how these issues are important to both Tunisia and Wyoming?
Both Tunisia and Wyoming have to deal with producing more agricultural products with less water.
Yeah.
Water management is incredibly important to both. Tunisians may be developing new technologies and new techniques in very arid environments that could be useful here and vice versa. Likewise, in terms of animal husbandry, this is a very important sector for both Tunisia and Wyoming. But there's an added possibility there, at least in my mind, where you could see perhaps Wyoming beef or bison exported to Tunisia for further processing and then export to Europe, taking advantage of those free trade agreements. For example, you could see also research taking place with sub-Saharan African faculty and students and research centers, but in Tunisia, because they've got the security and the stability and the infrastructure and those relationships going back decades with these sub-Saharan African institutions, you can see Tunisia becoming the platform for that training and education and that research together with the University of Wyoming. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for both sides to benefit from this engagement. I think there's a lot of areas where both Tunisia and Wyoming have challenges that they need to address. Sustainable tourism is one that you mentioned. Yeah. Tunisia gets about 10 million tourists every year. Unfortunately, most of them just go to the beach and don't spend a whole lot of money. And they don't benefit from the great cultural richness that Tunisia has to offer. So the University of Wyoming, I think, can help small and medium enterprises in Tunisia figure out how to create more experiential tourism and more niche markets that they can attract higher spending tourists to come to Tunisia to take advantage of.
You might have answered this already, but I'm going to ask it specifically. Maybe something will come out of it new. But what's something you think Wyoming could learn from Tunisia?
You know, diplomats love to repeat themselves, so but I'll try not to here. I think that there's a lot of different areas where Wyoming could learn from and gain experience from Tunisia. There's a lot of smart faculty and students there. For example, I was talking with a dean today who was asking about archaeological developments, archaeological research. Well, I, for sure, because Tunisia has such a long history of being the crossroads of so many major civilizations, there are thousands of archaeological sites waiting to be explored. And that would be great experience for archaeologists from the university, for people interested in cultural tourism development, for people interested in history, people learning about how society works, you know, you name it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be gained there for the Wyoming side.
And is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't mentioned yet?
I think that Tunisians really have had to hustle over their history. They don't have major reserves of oil and gas like most other countries in the region. And so their private sector is small but extremely dynamic. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it provides a platform for training, for education, for research, going all the way into sub-Saharan Africa and also into Europe, and especially for export into Europe. So what I would love to see is Wyoming faculty and students working together with Tunisian counterparts to develop new technologies, new things that can be exported and produced there or processed there in Tunisia and then exported out to different countries.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me today, Ambassador Hood.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was U.S. Ambassador to Tunisia, Joey Hood, speaking to me about new partnerships between the Northern African country and the University of Wyoming. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. A big thanks to Ivy Engel, our audio and digital producer today, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.